mythical lessons land differently when you hear them than read them. This from today's guest and author, Meeting the Melissae. Looking back 4,000 years to the bee priestesses unravels some of the mystery, and in so doing, brings the connecting mysteries of life front and center, back where they belong. I'm Robin. Join me today with Elizabeth, Ashley, for Tributaries. I quoted you in the intro that mythical lessons land differently when you hear them than read them. How so?
Oh, I said that because it's the way that information is fed from person to person within the hive for knowledge lectures. And I don't really understand why it happens. Maybe we use different parts of the brain. I don't know. But you definitely, if you've got your eyes closed and you're listening, you have these beautiful pictures appear, and they're different to reading them, certainly. And I don't know, when I was writing the book, it was much harder to kind of make the mythical connections than it is when you listen. You know, they come obviously when you listen, but when you write them down, they don't. You seem to be using a more logical part of your brain somehow.
Yes, definitely. And in writing this book, Meeting the Melissae, the Ancient Greek Bee Goddesses of Demeter, you've become quite a historian. Almost every page felt like it could be a full interview in itself. So let's just start with, after the serpent, the bee is the most represented symbol, and I'd venture to say that most are aware of the serpent's place, but not so about the bee. What is your take on that?
Yeah, I find that fascinating too. Although, if you look, certainly in Christianity, there is a lot around the bee, but it's been almost like kind of usurped, really, as this sort of beautiful symbol for benevolence and for community and for industry and, of course, for honey. But because so much of this came from women's knowledge and women's knowledge has been suppressed, it wasn't really as easy to glean that as it is for the serpent. You know, the serpent, it has, I think, around about 300 different interpretations, the serpent, but in like shamanic teachings. But really, because the women's knowledge was suppressed, we kind of only really have this idea of like the sense of evil or the rising of the Kundalini, you know? So although we do know it, a lot of that has got lost too.
Right. And boy, we're going to be jumping around today. You've already hit upon something I wanted to chat about how important is it to bring up Maria Gabuta's understanding and portrait of and hesitancy to frame the early days as matriarchy. True power really has nothing to do with one or other, nor with power over anything.
I agree. I think that she's beautiful to read. I think that she's important because she opens our minds to the idea of the matriarchy. And also she's important from the point of view that she brings balance, because what we often hear is, oh, we're so against the patriarchy, so therefore the matriarchy must rise. And in some ways, that's just as problematic.
Definitely,
as
yes,
it was. But this idea of balance, especially in a woman's psyche. You know, I was brought up by a mum who was a working mum in the 70s. You know, she was one of the first workers, and she managed to do something that I thought was remarkable, that she didn't really take on the attitude of a man. You know, but then in the 80s, that became the way, you know, that you have to rise, you have to diminish your feminine side. So I think that what's interesting about this knowledge of the idea of, well, both are important. I think that's very empowering to women, that you can be both.
Yes, yes. And What is it about the plant lemon balm, also known as Melissa, that drew you in to this whole epic and odyssey?
Yes. Do you know, I keep thinking back to that, and I don't know. And I know that sounds like a very sort of evasive answer. I always hear plants speak. I've always been able to hear plants speak. They've always influenced my thoughts, and I've been able to come into contact with them and know what they were for. And that's probably because my mum could do it, and we were always taught that that was normal. In 2018, I produced and presented the first online summit for professional aromatherapists, and I interviewed around about 60 different authorities. It was very hot at the time, and it was incredibly exhausting. And I'd go out into the garden and I'd just touch the lemon balm, and I'd be just like, oh, I can carry on. You know, it was so refreshing. And whilst I knew a little bit about the chemistry of the lemon balm essential oil, I kind of just wanted to understand, well, why does that happen? You know, what do we know about that now? Because, you know, every day there's so much research going on in the clinical labs. So that's what I was chasing, really. And then I came upon this arcane, strange statement that these priestesses were called Melissa. And I've always got this fascination with old stuff, you know, a real Cancerian that way. The old stuff always has me in its grips. And I was, what does that mean? Who were they? What, you know, and it became quite an obsession for me. So the obsession wasn't really for the plant. It was, I don't know what that means. And that disturbs me.
Yes. Well, you certainly did a great deep dive.
Thank you.
Yes. Tell us then about the Melissa.
So, as I say, I'd found this arcane statement that the Melissae were the priestesses of the ancient Greek goddess Demeter. And that was all I'd got. And so that was fascinating to me, because we all think about how the ancient Greeks had a religion. And it already occurred to me, really, that that's odd, you know, that these are essentially fairy tales, but they're a religion. And then suddenly to find, well, there's these women who served these goddesses, that was really interesting to me. And I found that the priestesses had presided at what was the most important of the initiations of the ancient world. So the Eleusinian Mysteries, or the Mysteries of Eleusis, took place for around about 2,000 years, which, if we think about it, is about the same amount of time as Christianity's held its sway. So that's a very long time. And their job was to open discourse with the goddess. So they would clean the sanctuaries. They would dress the goddess each day. They would offer prayers and sacrifices. They didn't actually slaughter the animal for the sacrifice. Actually, there, interestingly, the most important job was to let out the death cry when at the sacrifice, which I thought was interesting. One trains all one's life to make a big death cry. And I would go on to find out that they were paid for these sacrifices and these prayers. And what was fascinating and astonishing to me was when you go to ancient Greece and you see a temple, and a temple is dedicated to a goddess, not a god, a goddess, then that came from the priestess's pocket. So the women and the priestesses had funded that. So if you imagine that, when we think about ancient Greece, we think about the Parthenon, which was to Athena. You know, that is a legacy left so long ago from these Greek priestesses, although, as I say, not to Athena. The Melissae were Demeter Core. So Demeter and her daughter Persephone, she was called the Core before she was snatched down into the underworld. But also there were Melissa at other sanctuaries. So importantly, at Ephesus, so the temple to Artemis at Ephesus was completely molded on the idea of a beehive, and the high priestess was called the beekeeper. Her priests were eunuchs, and they were called drones or Essenes. And when you look around Ephesus, so all the archaeology, the soldiers had shields which had bees on them, and it's said that Ephesus means city of the bees, and she was worshipped as the queen bee at the full and new moon. And also there was Melissa at Eryx, which is in Sicily, and they were sexual priestesses who worshipped Aphrodite. And it seems to be like an emulation of the highly sexed priestesses were emulating the queen bee and her fact that she accumulates all of this semen inside her. So sailors used to go, that was my favourite thing, all of these sailors, all of this semen came her way. And she collects it all. She only does like a couple of virgin flights, and then she goes down into the hive, into the darkness, and she becomes the egg layer. That is the most important thing that happens in a beehive. And it seems to be that these priestesses were emulating that. It's fascinating.
It is truly fascinating. Bee shamanism is their main lifestyle teaching. And how do you think it originated?
Well, we think, we don't know, but we think that it was bee shamanism. But if you go back in history, way, way, way back before ancient Greece, and you go to around about 25,000 years ago, you will see lots of cave paintings of a goddess surrounded by many animals. And of course, you often see paintings too of people collecting honey. And it's very easy to understand that the honey was the food of the gods. I mean, it still is today, isn't it? It's so delicious. And to, you know, to sit and wonder at a beehive of, they're taking in pollen, but honey's coming out of there. You know, that's a magical thing.
Absolutely.
And
yes,
you can imagine that in the early days, people would sit, you know, no Netflix. People would sit and watch things for hours. Mm. And you can watch a beehive for hours and see a million beautiful things.
Absolutely, yes. And you're right that you think the 21st century humans will have a hard time reintegrating the shaman archetype into our psyches. Share about that.
Well, I think we kind of just touched on it there, really, from the point of view that we have so many distractions, so many electronic distractions. But also, I think that we are very programmed to think about, even for me, even, I was not brought up in a Christian household. I was brought up in a pagan household. But if I say a prayer, it's Dear Lord. That programming overrides a lot of stuff about the spirits of the land. And so even if you don't really believe, I think that, you know, if somebody gets involved in an accident or something and you go to prayer, then you talk to the God rather than the spirits of the earth, which is the shamanistic way. But doesn't mean to say that there can't be a new generation of communing with the spirits, because like I say, I am always engaged with plant spirits and have learned to be engaged with bee spirits now, but my brain goes to that place first.
Sure. Did they get into the fact that the bees buzz at 110 hertz? And obviously that long ago in history, they weren't measuring things like we do, but did they relate that at all to humming, do you think? Or I know humming is becoming a thing now, helps the vagus nerve reset things in the body. Was there a meditation like that droney sound or something?
Yeah, so whether it was in Greece, we don't know, but certainly there's a very ancient yogic practice called Brahmari. And Brahmari is a kind of breathing meditation where one hums. And it is, and Brahmari Devi was the Hindu goddess of black bees. So they definitely had it in Hinduism. So we're probably looking at sort of Ayurvedics around about 5,000 years, isn't it?
Yes.
But if you... There's so many gaps in our knowledge, because if it wasn't written down, then it's not there. And if it's... And so much of our ways of believing things now is... It has to have been written down for us to believe it. But like I say, a lot of this is in oral record. But if you look and make sort of intuitive jumps, perhaps think of the beautiful temple that's in Malta, Halselefli, and they had painted honeycombs on their ceiling. And acoustics experts say that if you stood in the middle room of the it's like a dugout cave, if you stood out in the middle, then the sound reflected right out through the whole of the structure, and that does vibrate at 110 hertz. So it's very hard to know, isn't it? And of course, did they even express it the same way as us is the other thing.
During and after this writing, let me ask you this first. Where did you go to research all of this knowledge? There's, as you said, so much is not written, but so much is written. But did you just go A to B to C? You just sort of followed this line once you got started. Where was the most bizarre place ended up?
My bee shamanism teacher's lady called Ariella Daly, and I always made it a respectful thing to never go into the class and ask questions. So I would sit, listen, leave. But after about 6 weeks, I said, oh, this is, I'm just sinking under this information. She says, I know what it's like. She says, you're looking for A to B, but you go from A to S to T to Z, and then you find that B was in a different dimension. I went, yes, that's exactly what it's like. But so I'm very lucky that I live in a place called Ludlow, which is on the border of England and Wales. And in the next city along, which it's a funny name for a place because it's a tiny little place, but it's got a cathedral. Within Hereford Cathedral, we have what's called a chained library. So very, very ancient books around about 15th and 16th century. And so there was quite a lot of herbals and bits and pieces that I could draw from there. But really, it was... not so much looking at historical stuff, but looking about stuff that people had written about beekeeping. And there was a tremendous book written by a lady called Professor Joan Breton Connolly. And she had written amazing stuff about priestesses. And so going from what she'd written, then going to a museum to look at the artifact and reading around that was mainly how I did it. Yeah.
So what do you think it was about the lemon balm that was woven into the story so intricately?
So definitely the tie-in, the connection between the idea of a Melissa priestess and the bees is that bees communicate in three ways. So first of all, they buzz at us, definitely, but they dance and they also use pheromones, and one of their most regularly used pheromones is called Nazanov. And Nazanov is used for things like, well, when the newbies go out, as my son calls them, the newbies, that are about 3 weeks old to go out to forage, the older bees emit Nazanov to say, this is home, don't forget where you're coming back to. And likewise, when they decide where they're going to swarm and they go, this is our new home, they mark it with Nazanov. And Nazanov has an almost identical chemical structure to the lemon balm scent. Now, I don't know how they could have known that all of those years ago. But even Virgil wrote that if you don't want your swarm to disappear, then you rub lemon balm inside of your hive. So they did know it. And there's this idea, I think, of welcoming, you know, there's a lot even still left now in Greece that they have a thing called xenia, that you welcome strangers, you give lots of wine and food and you make everybody welcome. Well, that is the bee pheromone that says welcome. I think that's probably what it was. Yeah.
And so as, my gosh, you've been an aromatherapist and really well-studied, a lecturer, author of books and everything. What is lemon balm for you?
It's a plant to stay well away from after the chaos. But it is a very joyful plant. And it's wonderful for depression. There are lots of things in the plant that don't necessarily transfer across to the essential oil. So lemon balm as a plant is very good for weight loss and for memory, for dementia. But the plant itself, the essential itself, really is about lifting the spirits, lifting the mind, helping you to concentrate and do maths better, believe it or not. For some reason that happens, but also very good for sleep. But for me, it's, I've spent my time with her, and I, until I get dementia probably, she and I will keep our distance for a while.
Well, it's interesting. When I started looking into it, the essential oil is quite expensive. And you think about the fact that it's a plant that grows anywhere almost, right? And everywhere. So then I found out about how when you do make the oil, there is not very much oil in the plant itself, but you could make certainly a hydrosol, a water essence. And what is it about that aromatherapy aspect of a plant that speaks to, oh, this one has a lot or this one has a little? I know rose doesn't have a lot. That's a reason why rose oil is expensive as well. Are there certain properties that create that scenario in a plant? And
yeah, definitely. And it's more obvious than you would imagine. It's that the constituents are not all oily. So if you think of witch hazel, for example, we all know witch hazel, that is a hydrosol, a hydrolat, and that's because none of the medicinal properties go across in as oil. They're all watery. But some plants have huge amounts of yields of essential oil. Others have very small, and as you quite rightly say, lemon balm, I think, is 0.003%, which is very strange considering it's a very, very strong smelling plant, isn't it? But yeah, it's usually that the constituents are more watery than they're oily.
You know, this is sort of an aside, but it's something you mentioned in the book. Tell us about the practice of earth sipping. What is that?
Oh, earth sipping. So earth sipping is a process, a breathing exercise done by the priestesses, involving the perineum. So it's very much, rather than being like a bee shamanism thing, Melissa were bee shamans and womb shamans, and this is the womb shaman side, that they use control of breath, they use control of breathing to draw up the energy of the earth up through what they call the lower mouth, through the vagina, up into the womb to hold it, then to do like a transfer of energy, of sending their energy back down into the earth. And it's a very grounding process, and it's very hard as well. So I can remember, so if anybody like wants to get into strengthening their pelvic floor, this is an excellent place to start. But it's not quite your pelvic floor. It is the actual perineum that you're drawing up and dropping with your breath. And it's almost the opposite. So as you breathe in, you push the perineum down. As you breathe out, you pull the perineum up. So you've got like a almost like a suction of energy coming up. And I found it so difficult to do. So I went to my next task and I went, I've done it. I've done 3 rounds of 6. And she went, well done. So the bee mistress can do 144 rounds of 6. And I just went, I'm out. It's really difficult to do. But it is, it forms a lot of the basis of the rituals. So, for example, I didn't say earlier that the Oracle of Delphi was Melissa. She was Melissa Delphis. And when she was doing her prophecy, she sat over the omphalos, which looks like a bee skep if you look, and it forms the beginning of her meditation, which I won't describe the rest, but she starts off by doing that, and it's that exchange of energy that begins the ecstatic prophecy, that movement, sexual energy through the body. Yeah.
Anyone reading the book will be changed by many or at least a few things in this book. And I'm wondering how it has affected you in your life as a gardener, your life as an aromatherapist.
Thank you for saying that. I was very changed because, as I've alluded to, I was brought up in a pagan household, a magical household. My mum was a third degree witch. And I was very much of the mind that I am not a witch. And I still say I'm not a witch. Now I understand that I never was a witch. I was a Melissa. Mm. So to have found a way to access that magical aspect of me, I felt like I'd come home. It was a very big thing to me. And how it's changed my gardening. My gardening is I don't do the garden. I leave it to the man I call the strong, silent one. The garden was so neat before the bees moved in because they moved in of their own accord. And now they go around planting borage everywhere around the garden. It looks like a wilderness. I hate it. And I'm, no, it's late pollen. You mustn't touch it. I've wrecked the garden. Oh, it's so beautiful, though. It's so funny to see because I know that I planted one borage plant 2 years ago and there is about 150 as a hedge right in front of the hives now. All they're doing is going to those borage bushes and back, borage bush, back. Lazy things. And in terms of how it changed my aromatherapy is very seated in science right now. You know, we want evidence for everything. And also we want to be able to understand the safety and the quality. All of that is spectacular. However, I felt like now my job is to remind people these are plants. These are spiritual beings.
Many thanks to Elizabeth Ashley, also known in the world as the Secret Healer. I was reminded of an interview I did with Simon Buxton years ago about his life in bee shamanism. I'm going to air that in 2 weeks on our next show. For any guest information or anything tributaries related, it's tributariesradio.wordpress.com. Our podcasts are where you hope to find them, and we're getting set up on YouTube, so you can check that out, and we'll be there soon if we aren't already. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for staying tuned.